I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, will the resignation of two top ministers impact the fundamentalist stand on homosexuality? But first, the serious illness of a Democratic senator has the potential to tilt the balance of power back to Republicans just weeks before the Democrats were to take power in Washington. Democratic Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota is recovering from overnight surgery to stop bleeding in his brain. Doctors say it's too soon to tell even if he'll survive. Senator Johnson started feeling ill yesterday and appeared to become disoriented while on a conference call with reporters.
It's frustrating that.
Difficult to listen to. There is, of course, concern about Johnson's health, but there is a math equation as well. In the November elections, the Democrats won a 51-49 Senate majority. If Johnson is unable to return to the Senate, North Dakota's Republican governor can appoint a replacement, presumably a Republican, putting the GOP back in charge. Joining us with more from Washington is Boston Globe congressional correspondent Rick Klein. And Rick, first, to Senator Johnson's condition, we understand he suffers arteriovenous malformation. It's something that affects about 300,000 Americans. He was born with it, and it affects the brain. How serious is this?
Well, it really depends. A lot of people that have this don't ever have symptoms, and the symptoms vary very widely. The biggest problem is the condition that led to his hospitalization, which was bleeding in the brain. That's something that we believe caused a disorientation and caused him to be rushed to the hospital. He underwent surgery last night. We're being told he was in stable condition. Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, the Democratic leader, visited him today, said that he looked very good. But the prospects for recovery is still very unknown at this point.
Right. You were at the White House Christmas party last night when this news broke of his condition. What was it like in the room?
Well, people were really buzzing about it. People looking, checking their BlackBerries, hearing from their offices about it. And, all the speculation about the possibilities of a 51-49 Senate changing to a 50-50 Senate really sort of, you know, got everyone, you know, obviously concerned about Senator Johnson's condition and also game planning some of the possible fallout of this incident as we try to figure out what exactly would happen in the event of a vacancy.
Well, there is some precedent for a disabled lawmaker staying in the job, and there's also some coincidence, a terrible coincidence here, because Johnson now has the same seat that Republican Senator Carl Mundt once held, and Mundt suffered a stroke while in office in 1969. But served till the end of his term in 73, even though he was unable to attend Senate sessions. If Johnson isn't able to go to work, I mean, is there some thinking that he will sit on the bench?
There is no provision in state or federal law that requires a senator to step aside because of health reasons or incapacitation, and there's no mechanism for that decision to be deemed on them, for them to be sort of taken out of the Senate as a result of health issues. And there have been many examples of senators missing months, even years worth of official business as they recover from or just cope with serious debilitating illnesses. In both the House and the Senate, this has happened over the years. So unless Senator Johnson decides to resign or indeed passes away, a vacancy will not occur, and he will be a United States senator even if he doesn't attend any official business to the end of his term for another 2 years.
Well, Mike Rounds is the Republican governor of South Dakota. If he were to be in the position of appointing a successor to Johnson, it's expected that he would appoint a Republican. But former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is from South Dakota. Is there a sense that the voters might launch a campaign?
Well, I think he'd become under a lot of pressure nationally, certainly, to appoint another Democrat. But anyone in the Republican Party would say, wait a second, you know, you'd be really betraying your party if you deny the Republicans an opportunity to take over the Senate, regardless of the circumstances that led to it. So, Senator Daschle is certainly a possibility if you were willing to come back. The one House member from South Dakota, Stephanie Herseth, is also a Democrat. She's been talked about as a possible Senate candidate against the Republican Senator John Thune, the one who beat Daschle 2 years ago. But this is all speculation at this point until there's more information about Senator Johnson's condition.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe, will stay on the story. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this past weekend, the Reverend Paul Barnes, pastor of a suburban church in Denver, resigned after admitting to having had sex with men. Barnes' departure comes on the heels of the resignation in November of Ted Haggard, who'd been the head of the National Association of Evangelicals and pastor of the New Life Church in Colorado Springs. Haggard was one of the most powerful evangelical leaders in the U.S. He had the president's ear, a mega church in Colorado. Well, today we're going to look at how those two revelations might impact the evangelical position on homosexuality and the political power of the movement. Jeff Charlotte is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and research scholar at New York University Center for Religion and Media. He wrote about Ted Haggard's megachurch for Harper's before last month's revelations. And Jeff, I'll ask you first, are you surprised by the new revelations from a second minister, Reverend Paul Barnes?
No, I'm not. And I think even within Christian conservatism, they've been expecting more and more of these outings to follow Ted Haggard's outing as this becomes sort of a bit of a witch hunt within the movement.
What do you mean by that? Are they looking within the movement?
They are looking within the movement. And Pastor Barnes did resign after there's some... No one's quite clear on this, but someone said we're going to out him if he doesn't come up and say this on his own. I think they are realizing that there are a lot of gay men within the leadership of the movement, and they obviously, because they're against that, they want to purify their ranks and purge their ranks, but also because they think that they can help these men. They think that they can cure them, as they understand it, of homosexuality. So they feel that they were remiss with Ted Haggard, that they let Ted down by not paying attention to what they should have seen as cries for help.
Well, that partly answers my next question, because as you know, many are wondering what impact these revelations will have on evangelicals and their view towards homosexuality. Some reports are asking, will this make them more compassionate? The New York Times quotes a Baptist minister and sociology professor not sympathetic to gay rights, who says that maybe evangelicals will see that they've oversimplified homosexuality, they demonized it, they've been mean.
Yeah, they've been mean, and now they're going to be nice, but that's not going to change their politics, and it's not going to change the way that they respond to Ted Haggard. And the interesting thing is that what happened is that this sort of confirmed their views. I mean, we saw this play out in the Colorado elections, where both the sort of there was two referendum items that could be interpreted as bearing on gay rights, and both went against gay rights in much higher numbers than anyone had predicted. So in some ways, the Ted Haggard drama pushed people into a firmer sense of their views. They'll be more compassionate to those within their movement who they discover have these inclinations, but they're not going to change their views. And if anything, they're going to be more vigorous in their sort of ferreting these things out.
Well, let's remind people of what the views are.
The view is very negative, obviously. At one point I was there, I was interviewing a young man. I thought that he was engaged, and I said, "Do you have a fiancé?" And the guy really popped up like he was going to hit me, and he thought that I had said, "Are you gay?" And it was this absurd Woody Allen kind of a moment of people hearing these insinuations that weren't there.
And you made some pretty keen observations that seem, when we reread the article, pretty foreshadowing. For instance, your remark on how homoerotic the art was in the church. Would you describe that to us?
Yeah, they have in the World Prayer Center, they have a gallery. And when I visited, they were having an exhibit of paintings of sort of Christian themes, most of which seemed to involve really muscular, bare-chested men and sort of states of very intense emotional fervor. And one in particular called The Vessel, which shows these two sort of almost naked, very buxom angels pouring vats of what seemed to be honey on top of a really handsome, again, bare-chested man, and then that spills down into a great vessel held at crotch level, from which the honey overflows, presumably, onto the world, providing us with our blessings. And I thought, this is soft porn. I was just sort of astonished by these images.
Well, and I want to hold you up there, because I can hear people saying, well, wait a second, my church features the beautiful men who followed Christ. There are many churches now wrestling with the issue of homosexuality. What, in your view, is different about the way the evangelical church that you visited, and the Haggard Church in particular, in the way they viewed homosexuality? I know you spoke to one woman who talked about demons that can jump into you.
Yeah, there's a fair number of people in the church who will interpret, not the entire church, but will interpret homosexuality as a demonic demonically caused. And then there's others like James Dobson, who will interpret it, who is a big sort of fundamentalist leader, interpret it as a kind of disease, as a pathology. The one sort of overriding theme I think that one notices is the centrality of this archetype of the gay man as almost a seducer. And in the same way that in classic sort of fundamentalism in American history, you had this sort of Jezebel character. You had the loose woman who was the threat. And what's really happened is that American Christian conservatism has responded to feminism. And they realized, hey, we were too sexist. We don't, you know, we were demonizing women. We don't want to do this. And so with that Jezebel character gone, they've replaced it with this archetype of the gay man. And, of course, that's kind of corresponded with the rise of the gay rights movement as well.
Well, you know, when did that happen? And I found the portion where you're talking to Linda at her home, and she's explaining that demons are cold. We're surrounded by demons. They are cold. They need bodies. They long to come inside. One way for them to come inside is to be sinned against. If you're molested, a demon will jump in. The other is to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You could walk by sin, a homosexual act, and a demon will leap onto your bones. A couple of questions. We were thinking this ourselves. When did this happen, that it went from being a female figure that could seduce you, a Jezebel, to a male? And how much of that thinking that sin could, as a demon, leap into you, how much does that have to do with the fact that these mega churches are in places like Colorado, away from major cities?
Well, to answer the first question, the first part of the question, when did this happen? I think it really blossomed as a central theme for the movement and around the early 90s and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And I should say there's a lot of Christian conservative thinkers who make the same analysis. They recognize how their movement is evolving. And with the loss of sort of communism as the great principle against which to organize, sexual issues became more and more important. That, of course, paralleled, I think, a trend that's been going on a little bit longer of the rise of these sort of ex-urban communities, like the sort of the ring of population around Colorado Springs. They don't people at New Life Church generally don't like downtown Colorado Springs, which is a perfectly safe place, but they see it as very dangerous. They see New York City as very dangerous. They see, you know, Boston as you know, it's just Sodom and Gomorrah.
Do they really believe that the demons that are, you know, participating in sinful acts in the big cities can leap into them?
Some do, and they're in some ways excusing themselves. So you go to the city and you come back and you look at pornography, it might be because a demon jumped into you, not because you really wanted to disobey God. Of course, there's other people who would say, it's because you have an infection.
Is that how they can make a distinction between their minister and another gay man?
From their way of thinking, part of the reason that Ted Haggard succumbed to this is that he was on the front lines. And if you go and you look at his early books, he talks about how demons had targeted him for special attacks. A particular demon called Control would call him in the night and threaten him. He was the point man. And in the church, there's a sense that we let Pastor Ted down, and if we had been praying for him with enough strength, he would have been able to resist these evil temptations.
Jeff Charlotte wrote an essay on Pastor Ted Haggard for Harper's. Again, all churches have scandals, but how will Haggard's impact his ministry's goal of making America a Christian nation? Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about the impact of the recent resignation of Christian evangelical ministers after revelations of homosexual activity on the evangelical Christian movement. Ted Haggard, in particular, had weekly phone calls with the White House, had hoped to remake Christianity using a free market and globalization model before he stepped down from his post. Jeff Charlotte is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and a research scholar at New York University Center for Religion and Media. And Jeff, we want to say again that there are a lot of people who don't accept homosexuality, and they say it's because of their religious beliefs. But we are, though, talking about the evangelical fundamentalist movement, which has, as you write, demonized in many ways homosexuality. You say that that came perhaps as a reaction to the feminist movement, you know, no longer the woman as seductress, but the homosexual male. But I'm wondering, how much do you think this demonizing of homosexuality is because leaders such as the two we've been speaking of were struggling with their own inner demons, you know, perhaps a mirroring of their own struggle? Or is that too facile?
I mean, how can we know how many fundamentalist leaders are struggling with homosexual feelings in their own lives. What we can know is that in the last 10, 15 years, there's been this incredible boom in manhood books. And many of us remember The Promise Keepers and that movement of sort of Christian manhood. And The Promise Keepers kind of faded, but what grew out of that were more and more books, for instance, like Wild at Heart and Every Man's Battle, that really focused on men's sexuality and focused on men loving other men. These books are intensely homoerotic, even as they're homophobic. But because this has become the sort of central narrative of thinking about faith, of restoring the powerful man, it's become a sort of an obsession of the culture. So I think a lot of these leaders, whether or not they have sexual feelings that they're not ready to admit to, you're almost encouraged now to confess your sort of dirtiest thoughts. For instance, Pastor Jack Hayford, who was one of Ted Haggard's mentors and is one of the really leading figures of Christian conservatism in the last 30 years or so, he confesses in a book called Every Man's Battle that he used to have a problem where he would go to the bank and he would see an attractive teller and he would have to go out into the parking lot, and he found himself at one point tempted to masturbate. And so you have these figures of these guys, they're more sexed up than most ordinary people who don't have that problem. And they're reading books like Every Man's Battle, which advises, for instance, young men who are struggling with sexual temptation, straight or gay, to get an older man who's a mentor to whom they can call up and relate their sexual fantasies in great detail. You know, which is creating a sexual situation, to say the least.
It also gives me an opportunity to rush to say that, of course, we're talking about two ministers who've resigned, stepped down, and much as when you discuss the child abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, this is of course not about all evangelical ministers,
no,
but
not at all.
What these two do represent. And I just want to ask you, while we have you, you've also written recently an essay in Harper's on how the Christian right is presenting U.S. history. And that is in the news as well now. One of the figures revered is Stonewall Jackson, the brilliant and deeply pious Confederate general. And the evangelical reverence for Stonewall Jackson has been in the news recently because of a film that surfaced in the Defense Department.
A film by a sort of behind-the-scenes ministry for government and military elites called Christian Embassy. And I used it as an illustration for the themes that emerge in popular fundamentalist histories of Stonewall Jackson as this character who both loves authority and also is sort of in some ways just disinterested in authority. Stonewall Jackson obeyed God. Not generally in a sense, and this video of contemporary generals testifying in uniform in the Pentagon that more important than their duty to their country is their faith in God, and that's something that they want people to understand, and that they see their position, their powerful position, as a way to sort of talk about the gospel and spread the gospel. And this has become a controversy because they seem to be endorsing a particular religion and doing so in uniform.
Well, you're right that the goal of some evangelical fundamentalists is to recreate the Christian nation that they believe existed initially and was part of God's will but was destroyed by secularism. Given that, you know, our conversation was triggered today by the admission by a second evangelical minister that he is gay. How much of a setback towards that goal of recreating a Christian nation has been the disclosure of the sexuality of two major ministers working towards that goal?
You know, there's a fellow named Mel White, used to be the ghostwriter for Jerry Falwell until he came out of the closet on his own and has since become a great spokesman for men who are still evangelical Christians and are also gay. And I think he points out really correctly is that these outings, in fact, are probably going to strengthen the movement because other gay men around the country are going to see, A, the terrible shame that will attend if they get outed against their will, and B, that the movement is willing to cure them or restore them or whatever, you know, word that their particular denomination is using. So there's going to be probably a lot more men seeking that kind of those strange cures that attempt to rid you of all homosexual thoughts. And that's unfortunately only going to strengthen the movement's sense of itself as compassionate and therefore almost as moderate. They feel that they are really on the middle ground because they're not stoning gay men to death. They feel that they're really in a progressive stance, and I think a lot of people are going to be sort of seduced by that idea as well, that this is some kind of happy compromise, when in fact it leads gay men into a terrible, terrible, and dangerous place.
Jeff Charlotte is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, also a research scholar for the New York University Center for Religion and the Media. Jeff, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, as always, we want to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and your town. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, the legacy of Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator, was buried this week. We'll look at the role of the U.S. in propping up his regime. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. You're sitting at dinner, the telephone rings, you answer it, and the voice on the other end says, press?
1 immediately to get these rates lowered, as your offer is about to expire. Or press 3 if you wish to forfeit your possible interest rate reduction.
That's what's called a robocall, a recorded telephone solicitation. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, has proposed a ban on most of these calls and would prohibit companies from robocalling people without their written permission. The public comment period ends Monday. Now, people who hate these calls are for the ban. Businesses are largely against it. And there's also a classic turf war. Another federal agency, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, which currently regulates robocalls, is also against the proposed change. Charles Kennedy teaches law at Catholic University. He's an attorney with Morrison & Forster in Washington. And Charlie, please help us through this. What is the current law about robocalls?
Well, the backstory here is that you have two agencies that are regulating telemarketing in this country. That's the way the Congress set it up, and it's causing endless confusion now because you have the Federal Communications Commission permitting these robocalls to be made to people with whom the caller has a relationship.
Well, hold up right there, because that's where it gets sticky, because how do they define business relationship? It can be pretty broad.
It's a little ragged around the edges. Mm-hmm. Business relationship is defined as something you have if you've bought something from someone within 18 months, mm-hmm. or if you've made an inquiry, if you've inquired about their product or service within 3 months. And where it gets a little fuzzy, of course, is what is an inquiry. When have you inquired about a product? If you visited the website and asked to get some information, is that an inquiry? I guess most people would say it is.
You're saying then, just to be clear, that if you just buy something from someone or go on a website to think about it, the company can then say you have a business relationship and they can contact you with these calls up to 18 months after your purchase or a visit to the website, even if they're on the Do Not Call registry.
That's right. Even if you as a consumer have put your phone number on the Do Not Call registry, you will not then get calls from telemarketers that you haven't bought anything from, at least if they're obeying the law. But you will get, may get calls from people that you have bought from within the last 18 months.
So along comes the new FTC proposal, which is much tougher, and tell us how.
Well, it is tougher in the sense that you can make a pre-recorded call under the Federal Communications Commission rules to somebody with whom you have this so-called business relationship. But the Federal Trade Commission proposes that you not be able to use a pre-recorded call. And the FTC's rationale, among other things, is that the pre-recorded calls are cheaper for the telemarketer to make, and so you're going to get more of them than if they have to have live operators.
And again, added to the FTC proposal is that these businesses cannot make this pre-recorded robocall to you without your written permission. Now, you know, I'm reading that and thinking that probably means pretty much no robocalls, because who's going to give written permission for someone to send them a pre-recorded call?
Well, there has to be prior express consent, and yes, the Federal Trade Commission's rule effectively will shut down these so-called robocalls.
Now, you made an important distinction, though, and clarify for us. Do these rules apply to live telemarketing calls?
No, the new rule does not apply to a live call, so you can continue as a consumer to receive a live person calling you to promote a product or service if you've done business with that caller within the last 18 months. That will go on.
How would these impact the other automatic and live calls you get, the political campaign calls? Are they covered by these rules?
Oh, you'll still get those because politicians make laws, don't they? and you will continue to get calls from politicians. And some of the complaints I've heard came out of the recent political season where people say, look, telemarketers are nothing compared to the deluge of annoying calls I'm getting from politicians.
Well, you're saying that the politicians who have crafted these rules, whether FCC or FTC, have conveniently left out political calls from the equation.
Somehow that slipped through their net.
Although we should note the North Carolina Attorney General made a statement to the effect that he thinks that political calls should be included on the Do Not Call Registry. Do you think that's ever going to happen?
Not at the federal level, but, you know, the states also regulate telemarketing. And the states are free to come up with their own rules about this. And then, of course, there would be an inevitable challenge on free speech grounds, because when you're talking about political speech, that gets a higher level of protection under the First Amendment than commercial speech, so probably somebody would challenge it. But yes, North Carolina's legislature or any legislature could pass a more restrictive rule and catch the politicians.
Well, Charlie Kennedy, you started by saying that this is, in essence, you know, the problem is that there's two agencies regulating telemarketing, and, you know, this has been a bit of a turf battle. Who do you think is going to win, the FCC with the lighter ruling that allows more robocalls, or the FTC with what would be a pretty strict ban?
So far, the Federal Trade Commission has gotten the initiative and kept it. And if your listeners can bear with a little technical stuff for a moment, there is a jurisdictional fight here. The Federal Trade Commission has jurisdiction over most American businesses, but there are some exceptions. They aren't supposed to regulate banks, insurance companies, common carriers like your phone company. Those are carve-outs right in the statute that created the Federal Trade Commission. Federal Communications Commission gets to regulate everybody else. But the FTC has recently stated that it will move against telemarketing firms that are hired by companies that are themselves exempt from FTC jurisdiction. So, for example, if you're a bank and you're not subject to the Federal Trade Commission, you hire a telemarketing firm, you as a bank could follow the FCC rules and make the pre-recorded calls. But the Federal Trade Commission would say, that's fine, but we're going to go after your telemarketing company. That's a very aggressive move by an agency to encroach on the turf of another agency. And the Federal Communications Commission could push back, but then they might be perceived as being soft on telemarketers, and who wants that?
And the fact is, it would be better for most consumers if the FTC wins out in this turf battle, because they don't get these annoying calls at home. But you advise companies. What do you advise that they do, given, you know, that there's this debate and discussion over the rulings?
I would have to advise them to be very cautious about violating the Federal Trade Commission rules at this point.
And not try to make an end run, as you suggested some might.
Well, certainly people who and companies who want to oppose the rule or have concerns about it have an opportunity to file with the Federal Trade Commission. The deadline is December 18th, and companies who are affected by this should certainly take that opportunity. It's hard to turn this momentum around. The last time the Federal Trade Commission had a proceeding on this subject, they had only 23 comments filed by business interests. They had about 12,600 filed by consumers, most of whom, as you imagine, didn't want to be called.
Charlie Kennedy, adjunct law professor at Catholic University and an attorney with Morrison & Forster in Washington, D.C. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for a link to the FTC's website, go to ours, here-now.org. Well, still to come today, the voice behind The Simpsons and Spinal Tap, and now he adds author to his resume, Harry Shearer. He's still ahead in the program. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it was almost at the last possible moment, but it looks as if the Boston Red Sox have landed the Japanese pitching ace they've been wooing for the past month. Now, why do we bring this up? Yes, we are in Boston, but we were struck, and maybe you will be as well, by the $103 million price tag. Yesterday, Daisuke Matsuzaka arrived in Boston for his physical, and a press conference has been called for later today, presumably to announce that he's been signed to a contract. The Red Sox have until midnight tonight to sign him. Here to talk about that acquisition and the rest of the news from the world of sports, our ace, only a game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, hello.
Hey, Robin.
Break down that $103.1 million.
Right. $51.1 million to the corporation that owns the Cebu Lions, the previous employer of Mr. Matsuzaka, and $52 million to Matsuzaka himself over the next 6 years, and all he has to do is pitch for the Red Sox.
Well, it is hard, that little square, you know, that you got to throw it in. But at one point, his agent wouldn't even let him meet with the Red Sox. What changed?
Well, his agent began by saying, hey, this is a $100 million pitcher, meaning they should have paid him or built for him a contract worth $100 million.
On top.
The $50 million they had to pay to the Cebu Lions in addition. And that didn't turn out to, I think the Red Sox probably impressed the pitcher and his agent greatly by flying out in Mr. Henry's private jet and bidding against themselves and doing all those other good things that they sometimes do.
Well, is it worth it in your mind? Were other teams trying to get in too?
Well, we don't know because of the very curious arrangement where the Red Sox had to pay the money up front for the opportunity to talk to this guy. Mm-hmm. We don't know. There were certainly other teams bidding for that opportunity, and the Red Sox outbid them. Whether another team would have made this sort of deal, of course, there are a fairly limited number of Major League Baseball teams with the resources to make this sort of deal.
Well, we shall see how that works out. Speaking of deals, there's a possible trade in the NBA that's been flying around for weeks. The Philadelphia 76ers. Star guard Allen Iverson, AI.
Yep.
He's had troubles with injuries, you know, some personality conflicts. How is he going to be wanted?
Well, fewer troubles with injuries than almost anybody else on the planet would have had with his injuries. One of the things that Iverson is famous for is playing through injuries that would have put lesser players, less determined players on the bench. As many as 9 or 10 teams have expressed considerable interest in somehow acquiring Iverson. The 76ers really want to get this deal done because they have basically declared whatever else he is, he's no longer part of this team. There was a little detail in a story earlier this week that they'd ripped his name tag off the locker.
Ouch.
In the clubhouse. That's pretty final, kind of like ripping the epaulets off somebody when you throw them out of the corps.
Right.
So they certainly hope that this deal gets done soon and that they get some sort of legitimate compensation for, you know, arguably the greatest scorer in the game right now.
Well, I want to stay with basketball just a second. This week, a lot of the players rejoiced when Commissioner David Stern announced the old leather ball would be coming back. The players seemed to hate the new microfiber composite ball. They said that it hurt them?
Yeah, well, some of them have said that little bits of the microfiber have cut their fingers when they've played with it, and others have said that it bounced in a peculiar fashion, especially bouncing off the rim. I think that the most interesting thing about this story is that the commissioner, Mr. Stern, has said, hey, I goofed. And commissioners very rarely say that. And he said, I goofed. I should have listened to guys like Steve Nash and Shaquille O'Neal and other star players who don't like the ball. And so it's out and the old one's back in.
Okay, finally, we've only got about a minute. But this weekend on your show, you have your annual gift-giving guide, which is, we just love this. Just tell us quickly what you're excited about this weekend.
Well, I don't want to give too much away
because,
you know, it is, of course, one of the highlights of the Only a Game calendar. But one of my favorite items in the gift guide this time around is the Cruisin' Cooler. And the Cruisin' Cooler was invented by a man who watched a guy and a woman fighting at a NASCAR event over who would carry the cooler full of their favorite beverage. And so he's invented a cooler that has wheels and a motor. And as long as you don't weigh more than 500 pounds, you can sit on it and drive it anywhere you want.
And as usual, the Only a Game staff has been trying out all the gifts, and they've just been unusually happy this week.
It's been a great week.
Thank you so much. Make sure you catch Only a Game this weekend. The gift segment is always fun. Bill Littlefield, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Oh, and you'll have sports as well. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Gamage, a town in upstate New York, has hit the skids. Factories are closed, the roads are potholed, the school's gym is branded Puma, and the school books thank MTV. It's so depressed that even Walmart won't build there. That is, until the mayor plots to get everyone in town to declare themselves Native American so Gamage can open up a casino. That's the farce behind Not Enough Indians.
Hiya, hiya, hiya! Come on, let's all do it now! Anna Manybirds was dancing around the floor of the gym at Krista McAuliffe High, her heavy crimson shawl swinging behind her as she swayed this way and that, swooping first one shoulder floorward, then the other, in the Eagle Dance. Slowly, reluctantly, some 300 townspeople in the city of Gamage trooped down out of the stands onto the gym floor and attempted, with varying degrees of accuracy, to mimic her movements and her noises.
Hiya, hiya, hiya,
they murmured asynchronously. But making an application to be recognized as an Indian tribe did require learning something about being some kind of Native American, Mayor Curtis Zorn had argued at the select persons meeting when the plan was approved. They're obviously going to send somebody here to see some Indians, so it seems to me, at the very least, we got to show them some Indians.
Author Harry Shearer reading from his book, Not Enough Indians, and Harry joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
You really did try to learn an eagle dance when you were researching this story. What an image. What else inspired it?
Really, first of all, just amazement and amusement that this grand historical switcheroo occurred where the most despised among us were now sitting on a big money pile and white folks could envy them.
Mm-hmm.
And second, when Fox was opened, the New York Times ran a piece that they revealed, among other things, that at that point, the Mashantucket Pequots had one full-blooded member living on tribal land. And I just thought, take away one and then you got some.
And, of course, Foxwoods, for those maybe not in the East, you don't know, this is here we know it well as the Meet Me at Foxwoods. It's the gambling, huge gambling empire now
it's,
in Connecticut.
If I can use the word mecca.
Yes, you can.
Without ruffling feathers. Yeah, I think it's the largest Native American casino in the country.
So you write about this town in upstate New York, this fictional town, but one that we can picture very well that's dying. And so they discovered that the Filiquansets, the unfortunate tribe that was killed by some virus-infested washcloths.
Well, they're not smallpox-infested blankets, but it's close.
So they discover that this tribe had lived on their land and pull this scam with a list of characters that stretches from Las Vegas to Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
To upstate New York, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs,
yeah.
Which, as you write, was to the Interior Department what UPN was to television networks, the Yugo of government agencies.
If not the Geo Metro.
Then there's the local public radio station that gets in on the Indian Act in Gamage with shows like Finding Your Inner Hawk or something like that.
It's a featurette called Finding the Hawk Within, the Inner Hawk.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm reading this. And I'm thinking, you know, I smell movie.
Mm.
You that in many ways. This
Maybe it's just popcorn you're smelling.
Well, that this would be, you know, a terrific in the sort of Christopher Guest,
mm-hmm.
Harry Shearer. But then on the other hand, you wouldn't get to write some of these sentences. You talk about a guy in Washington so close to retirement, he could taste the dentacream. The theme at the Native American Gambling Association conference, customs make customers. You wouldn't get to have that.
Well, that's the compromise you make whenever a book is turned into a movie. Christopher just emailed me over the weekend that he read the book and really liked it and said, boy, that'd make a good movie.
But how much is this writing, you know, that something that, you know, just with the film, it's not as much the written word as the scenes.
Well, of course
not.
The iron rule in all creative work is you have to kill your children. You take out that which you love but which gets in the way. That's the same thing you do when you edit a movie. And when you translate from one medium to the next, you know, God, I love these sentences. Goodbye.
Right.
You
see
know?
Ya.
See ya.
Well, let's get back to our story because we have the Filiquansets, but there's another tribe.
Yes, the Wawosas.
Mm-hmm, that gets wind of this and comes in to sort of smash the Filiquansets casino. But the Wawosas... They're not Indians.
Well, some of them are Indians. The guy who runs the casino married a woman who's 1/16th Wawosa, and that's apparently all it takes, really.
What ultimately happens here when the Wawosas, who are led, by the way, by a fellow named Katz, who changes his name to Catspaw.
Catspaw, yeah. he left his tenure in the women's fashion jeans business to go run the Wauwosa Casino and direct commercials with James Earl Jones as the voice of Wauwosa. Well, you don't want me to give away the ending, do you?
Well, it's in a way that you can tell us broadly.
Well, I mean, they go to Washington to try to get the recognition of the Philoquonsets withdrawn. One of the things that I find so amusing about this whole spectacle is the premise of Indian casinos escaping state regulation is because the tribes are, quote, sovereign nations. And yet they can't do this until they troop to Washington and have their sovereignty recognized by a bureaucrat in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So, yes, you're sovereign, but we have to say you are. It's almost like they're little Iraqs.
Right. There you go. I'm thinking of all the voices that you do. To name just a few, Derek Smalls. He's the cucumber-packing bass player from Spinal Tap, the devious Mr. Burns from television's The Simpsons, and Victor Allen Miller from Christopher Guest's newest film that's for your consideration.
Do you feel that playing rock and roll music keeps you a child? That is, keeps you in a state of arrested development?
No. I feel it's more like going to a national park or something, and there's, you know, they preserve the moose, and that's my childhood up there on stage, is that moose, you know.
You sure about a doll? Why not write a musical about the common cat or the king of Siam?
I'm working for scale. An actor of my stature, 40 years in the business, there's no excuse for me working for scale.
No, when that's
so many, you know, I can't name them all.
Burns, Smithers, Principal Skinner, Ned Flanders, Reverend Lovejoy, Kent Brockman, Scratchy, Lenny, Dr. Hibbert, Dr. Marvin Monroe, McBain, Kang. There's a few. God, the Devil, and Hitler rounds out the bunch on The Simpsons.
Well, given that, are you doing all these voices when you're writing it?
No, I'm actually having to deal with that now because I'm going to be sitting down in a couple weeks to do the audiobook.
Oh, one could only hope.
Yeah. Most of these people in this book are not people I made up. They're people I know or people have been in my life at one time or another. So I really heard the real people talking, so I didn't have to make up voices for them. The couple that are made up are Tony Salata, the great classy Vegas gambling magnate, who's you know, built an impressive edifice of new breastworks for his former dance showgirl wife, Serena. Nothing like that ever existed in real life, so I had to make that up.
Okay.
I just think, I'm a believer that the funniest stuff around is what people really do. Put enough of it together and maybe you got something.
Hmm. Harry Shearer, his new book is called Not Enough Indians, the story of a small town in upstate New York that tried to save itself by finding its very, very, very distant Indian past. Harry, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And we are proud to say that today's credits are from The Simpsons newscaster, Kent Brockman.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Metzen, Hitesh Hati, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer, our web producer is Ken George, and our intern, Katie Falsigno. Managing editor is Chris Ballman, the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Kent Brockman.
And I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.